The following is brought to you by Will Harris, Dustin Campbell, Daily Tech News Show, Andy Beach, Nick Wood, and Craig. Hello and welcome everybody to the Politics program for March 9th, 2022. Your old pal Justin Robert Young joining you as we always do here on the program. You know, we are in the midst of the midterms. We are in the midst of races that are going to decide the House, that are going to decide the Senate. And we are going to talk about stuff that is happening on Capitol Hill. But it is odd that we have so much of the oxygen taken up by a foreign policy conversation in what is often a particularly domestic time on the political calendar. Let's remember back to the Obama era. I mean, Obamacare running up to that first midterm was something that was inescapable. We've fussed and feuded about border walls and dreamers in more recent incarnations. And yet, with such a historically aberrant military incursion happening in Europe with nukes on the board, well, it's hard to turn your head and look at anything else. We will discuss a United States executive order to no longer import Russian oil. UK going along with that too. Exactly what does that mean? Spoiler alert, not a ton for us, but does it put tremendous pressure on the EU, which is far more dependent on Russian oil? Yes, indeed. We will break all of that down. We also may actually finally possibly could fund the federal government. That would be a fun, interesting change. This is something that has been kicked down the road so many times that the can might well be shattered into atoms if anybody tries to do it one more time. But it looks as if an omnibus spending bill will come through Congress. Both sides want to get it done. What are the remaining issues? We will tell you those. And we're going to do a little bit of citizens research, citizens breakdown. This is not an expert breakdown, but one of the elements that I think you guys appreciate about this show is, number one, what we wind up getting a lot is the fact that there is a lack of partisanship. But the other thing is that you guys seem to appreciate when there's a little bit of a revelation of how I put these things together, the bits of research that I do, so I don't fall into certain traps of being, you know, caught up on one side or the other. That is something that you guys seem to appreciate. And so we are going to do that with Ukraine, and specifically something that was a major thread during the Sunday shows. We're bringing on Tom Merritt, and we are going to discuss through our citizens research, is the Russian military falling apart? Has Russia allowed their military to rot to the point where what they assumed would be a incursion they could measure in days is now stretching into weeks? This was something that was mentioned a lot on the Sunday shows, as I mentioned, but there are things that you can look up on the internet that are not particularly controversial that give us some clues as to beyond quote unquote expert analysis that some of these things are true or not. Hopefully you guys enjoy it, because it is definitely not an expert opinion, but I do believe it is an informed opinion, and Tom, as always, is great. Bird first. It was the streetwise troubadour Daddy Yankee who said, "She loves the gasoline. Give me more gasoline." But the she in that song almost certainly could not be Lady Liberty after the executive order put in place yesterday by Joe Biden. This according to Politico. Biden will announce a Russian oil import ban on Tuesday, avoiding a fight with Congress and his own party, which was poised to act on such a ban if he did not. The announcement will complete a shift for the White House, which 2 days ago expressed fear that an import ban would send gas prices skyrocketing. Officials were hopeful to enact a ban in lockstep with European allies, but they are now adjusting to what has become an overwhelming bipartisan interest in Capitol Hill within corners of the administration in ridding the U.S. markets of Russian oil as Vladimir Putin continues his assault on Ukraine. Boris Johnson in the U.K. followed suit on that. So, before we go any further, let's break down exactly what all that means. Number one, Joe Biden is experiencing a little bit of a boost in the polls right now. Now, there are two reasons that I would imagine for that. A, COVID is getting better. Apparently, I was the last person on earth to get it. Two, you have this situation that is a foreign policy issue, and the good guys, from our perspective, are winning. Now, if Ukraine got rolled over and the popular Volodymyr Zelensky's body was trailed on the back of a Russian tank, maybe that would be different. But right now, this is kind of the best version of a foreign war that Joe Biden could hope for. He said Russia was going to attack. They did attack. And without the United States doing all that much, Russia's, if not losing, then no, they're losing. They're losing. I mean, if the point is capture the flag, you ain't captured the flag yet. And based on the size of these armies, that should not be much of a contest. And meanwhile, Joe Biden can, by and large, you know, wear a Ukraine pin, talk about how Russia needs to stop and the sanctions that are getting put on. So far, so good with most of those. They mostly got all the Russian banks off of SWIFT. And the problem is that a lot of the stuff that the United States has done does not have a tremendous effect on U.S. voters. In fact, really messing with Russian exports on oil and gas is the only thing that has had much of an effect on the average American. Right now, gas is the highest that it has been in the United States. According to AAA, this was from Tuesday, the average hit $4.17 a gallon. That is a record high, not adjusted for inflation. So if you ban Russian oil, and therefore you are hoping that you're going to do it in lockstep with the European allies, how does that affect the United States? Well, not a whole hell of a lot. The U.S. imports about 8% of its oil from Russia. At least that was last year. Most of our oil imports come from Canada, Mexico, Saudi Arabia. A reminder that we are the number two gas exporter, so we produce a lot of it ourselves. But Russian gas has increased over the past few years. This according to Barron's. In 2020, the U.S. imported 200 million barrels. The larger thing that this is going to affect is the world's price of oil. Oil is a one market. So anything that happens anywhere is going to drive the price either up or down. There's a reason why you have such tight controls by organizations like OPEC. So if the U.S. does this, and we don't really depend on Russian oil, and the U.K. does it, and they don't really depend on Russian oil, then how does this affect Europe? Well, according to CNBC, the EU imported 155 billion cubic meters of natural gas from Russia in 2021, almost half of its gas imports, and nearly 40% of the total amount used. Meanwhile, according to Eurostat, 39% of oil imports came from Russia in 2017. And by the way, for a few of these countries, including Estonia, Poland, Slovakia, and Finland, more than 75% of their imports for petroleum originated in Russia. Germany is also among those that are the most dependent on Russian energy. So if you are taking yourself out of the realm of buying Russian energy, and if you're the US and you're the UK, then you are effectively drawing a line in the sand saying that anybody who does do this is funding Vladimir Putin directly. So they kind of have to do something. The EU major power states, at least the ones that are very influential in NATO. And let's just fill in all of that with Germany. All right, Germany is our mascot for all this. Well, what are they planning to do? Well, something very European. The EU is going to outline a plan yesterday to cut Russian gas imports by 2/3 within a year to reduce its dependency on the country's fuel supplies after Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Also of note throughout all of this is that it needs to make sure that it adheres to their own version of the Green New Deal, the EU's version of their climate change provisions. So if they get off oil or they get off natural gas, then they're still going to have to maybe burn more coal. So that's where we're at right now. The U.S. makes a move. It was a move that Biden was probably going to be forced to make. Although you could make the argument that there is a political world in which Biden should have let Congress do this by themselves. Because at the very least, at that point, Republicans would have to take credit for it if the mood sours on high gas prices, which it is almost assuredly going to do eventually. That is something that to keep an eye on around the corner. Because gas prices right now are ridiculous. Upwards of $7 a gallon in some parts of California. And right now, you got Stephen Colbert on TV talking about how it's patriotic to spend a few more dollars at the pump. But inflation is inflation is inflation. When the adrenaline wears off of this war, and who knows when that's going to happen, how it's going to happen. But when the adrenaline wears off, which it will, if prices are still really high, then you are going to see blame. And if Biden did this by executive order, then he will be able to be blamed for it, regardless of the fact that the Republicans are also calling for the exact same move. You know, them's politics. You know, if gas is high and the guy did the thing, then you're going to blame the guy for the thing. It's just what it is. As of right now, the United States of America is being run on a budget that was put into place in December of 2020. Yes, under the tutelage of then President Donald Trump, who still believed he was the president, but that's a story for another day. In case you've been in a coma, I am currently talking to you on March 9th, 2022. That is a long time. And it's because the Biden-era Congress has issued continuing resolutions because they haven't been able to pass a full budget that would fund the federal government, despite the fact that the one they are operating on now is both out of date and from the wrong party, at least in terms of those that are in power right now. All of that might change in the next 48 hours. In fact, there is massive pressure and good vibes that there will be a new budget passed by the end of the week when the most recent continuing resolution expires. Should that not happen, the government would shut down. That's not going to happen, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on it. So what is holding up this massive budget? Let's go through a few things. Number one, there's going to be a lot more military funding than progressives want. Oh boy, that progressive wish list when Biden came into power. You remember when Bernie dropped out? Bernie dropped out earlier than he did against Hillary Clinton because he actually likes Joe Biden. And he talked about, oh, what a great partner this was going to be. And it certainly seemed that that was going to be the case. There was that whole, you know, the Bernie got to lead point on the Build Back Better stuff and keeping the bills united. Well, that didn't end up particularly well. And now another major progressive wish, which is that the Pentagon's budget doesn't continue to balloon and balloon and balloon, seems like it will go unfulfilled. Russia's assault on Ukraine means that the push to keep the Pentagon's desire for cash down has all but failed. There is going to be an enormous government funding measure expected to include a Pentagon budget of far exceeds the $715 billion that Biden initially had earmarked, with at least $10 billion more in emergency aid to help bolster Ukraine specifically from a military perspective. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, yep, Mitch McConnell wants to begin to rein in COVID-era programs that he views as dangerous for continuing to go on. Among them, a program giving out free lunches. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is forcefully opposing a provision in the omnibus spending bill that would extend a slew of waivers that have allowed schools to serve universal free meals during the pandemic. Quote, McConnell is not budging, said a person close to the ongoing negotiations. It hurts everybody in every state. These are things Republicans want. I'm getting the sense with this story that this is how they want to hit McConnell. This is a classic. Republicans are absolutely evil and they are looking for reasons to take your eyeball out of your socket and put it in your armpit. That's an old DC phrase. But I, from the Republican side, what I'm gathering from researching on this is what they want to do is just not make everything that happened during COVID permanent in a non-COVID world. So this is one of them. Speaking of COVID, we're getting billions of new COVID money. House and Senate appropriators are still trying to find offsets for billions of dollars in new COVID relief requested by the White House. The Biden administration has wanted $22.5 billion in new COVID relief money, but Republicans are rejecting their request without a, quote, accounting of the trillions of dollars in COVID funding already approved by lawmakers. Congress is likely to greenlight roughly $15 billion more, according to sources close to the issue. This, by the way, is something that is bipartisan. You know, a lot of the COVID money that was approved throughout the last 2 years that we've been dealing with this have had weird strings attached to it, including a sunsetting on when they were allowed to spend it, meaning that a lot of money is now unspent and not allowed to be spent. So I do think that there is a reasonable push to say, before we put a bunch of, you know, billions more into it, is there anything we can be that can be done with the dead money that has already been put into play and just quite simply not spent? Still, with all that being said, we are on the 1 yard line in football terms. This seems to be going to happen. Now, when? That's a big question. So by the time you hear this, there may or may not be a bill out there. Oh, by the way, by the time that I'm reading, giving you all this information, I'm at about noon Central Time on Tuesday. There still isn't a bill out there for people to read. This is going to be a trillions of dollars involved, and there is no bill for people to read, and they're expecting on votes at the very least by Friday, if not sooner. In fact, we may or may not have the bill in the House by the time that you listen to this, because the House is supposed to adjourn on Wednesday and allow Democrats to head to Philadelphia for an annual legislative retreat. So it will almost assuredly, if the House members want to go on their retreat on time, they will have to pass this and then send it to the Senate. The Senate will then have to pass it by Friday. But if we're talking about whether, if we're talking about the free lunch programs and progressives getting over the fact that the Pentagon is going to get another gigantic amount of money, then I think we're close. Biden might actually have his first budget. And before the midterms. Good job. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to support this show, there's only one place that you can go for bonus content. It's a bonus episode on Monday, a bonus episode on Thursday. Spoiler alert, we're going to do a feed drop for another non-PX3 show for Friday's program because, well, quite frankly, I got caught up, y'all. There is a thing that I have to go out of town for this week, and then combined with the fact that we had the whole COVID thing over the week before that, I'm just gonna need a little bit of a breather, and so we're gonna do another. I'm gonna give you content, but it just won't be PX3 content on Friday. But for folks who are patrons, you're still gonna get your podcast on Thursday covering the latest news that we can possibly cover on our PX3 podcast schedule. Head on over there. It is takepoliticsseriously.com. And before we go any further, I do want to shout out somebody very specific, because this man has given to the show in every way I think I know possible. He gave and a generous amount. Thank you. Over the Venmo, sent me a physical check to my P.O. box, and I believe supports the show via Patreon. So, Alan Y., thank you so much. Thank you. This is an independent operation. It is entirely funded by you guys. Head on over right now for bonus content. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Throughout the fog of war, all we can ever hope is that we are not actively fooling ourselves. There's no shame in not knowing, and there's no shame in declaring the areas that you do not believe yourself to be an expert. But even if you are somebody who knows everything about a subject, when you are talking about the highly cloudy and misinformation prone field of an active war zone, well, it's easy to get over your skis. And so, in the grand tradition of citizen analysis, I have convened somebody for whom I consider to be one of the best at doing his due diligence. He is the host of the Daily Tech News Show. He is my friend. He is your friend. He is the world's friend, Tom Merritt. Welcome back to the show, Tom.
Well, thanks for having me.
There is a very interesting thing that I think happens in both of our jobs, for me with politics, for you with tech, where we are learned people. We do research for a living. But oftentimes, you know, the more you become, you know, a quote unquote experienced in a field, you realize that there's a lot of stuff that's very complicated. And that also happens for us in our personal lives, like everybody, where you see things that are outside of your natural field of study and you just want to make sense of them. So you tweeted something last night that dovetailed onto points that were made on the PX3 Sunday show that I had just recorded, which basically boils down to this. Let me read your tweet first, and then I will tell you what was said on the Sunday shows. The Russo-Georgian War in 2008 was the closest thing the war in Ukraine in modern Russia has fought. It lasted 12 days with several hundred casualties and 192,000 or so displaced people. Right now, the war in Ukraine is entering its 12th day. And the reason why that stuck out to me is because I had just gotten done watching all these Sunday shows where various different people, politicians, military experts, people on the field, like, so not just one chattering class, not just State Department talking points, were all making the same point that Russia's military is not only not performing, it is quite possibly embarrassing itself on a nearly historic level. And your stat there, to me, it was like, oh, that would be a great way to judge whether or not that is realistic or a good observation, is to look at, well, how have they fought these last few wars? So I wanted to have you on just so we could talk through all of this and see what we can make sense of.
Yeah. Where my head was at, I actually wrote that while I was in a car wash, just, you know, waiting for the car wash to finish. Uh-huh. And as you do,
you are entering the car wash saying, I wonder what Russia's recent military record is.
Exactly. I've been hearing all of these comparisons to Russian military action, and, you know, Russia has fought previous wars in this or that way. A lot of analysis saying that they often go in, mess up a little at first and then start heavy bombardment to achieve their goals. And there were comparisons to Transnistria in Moldova, Chechnya, South Ossetia and Abkhazia in Georgia, as well as Syria, where they came in and aided
Bashar. Assad. So
I thought, okay, well, what was Georgia like? How does it compare to this? Because this, and my first question was, how long did it last? And when I looked it up, I was like, oh, 12 days. That's where we are now. Mm-hmm. And And where my head went then was, what was their approach in Georgia? And was it different? Did they go in and bomb? They took over four cities in Georgia.
Yeah.
From what I read, rather not neatly, but certainly compared to what they've done in Ukraine, much more neatly. And I also noticed that Russia went in with the world opinion much less against it than it did in Ukraine. It went in as a peacekeeping force, which, you know, roll your eyes, put quotes around it.
Yeah.
It also acted like a peacekeeping force by that 12th day. In fact, they had already started to stand down saying, we've achieved our aim of protecting the Russian minority in Georgia. You know, we are going to occupy these cities only as long as the peace arrangement can be implemented. They were already talking about resolving this in a way that they're not in Ukraine. The rhetoric around Ukraine has been, this action is going to continue until you meet our demands.
Yeah,
it's much more focused on the West, whereas in Georgia, for lots of different reasons, it was focused on, we really just want this territory, which is why when we talked on PX3 previously, I thought, well, maybe that's what he wants to do in the Donbass. He's just going to go in, take those over like he took over South Ossetia and then back off. And that's not what Russia is doing right now.
Can we just go back to that conversation? Because I felt really good about that conversation that we had, me, you, Brian, and Jen Briney, right after we did it, where I was like, man, there was a lot of context. I felt like I knew a lot more about it. But I think it was safe to say that all of us were skeptical of the State Department loudly ringing the bell that this was going to be a full-on invasion and tanks would be rolling toward Kyiv.
Yep.
And then that's exactly what happened. Like, the State Department gets the chicken dinner for being exactly right on that. And we, you know, in hindsight, looked maybe a little too scantsy pants at this notion. But at the same time, I can't help but look at what's happening and say, did the Russian military believe us on that podcast in the same way that we were skeptical of it? Because it kind of looks like it. Like, it looks like this is a totally disorganized thing when you compare it to either what we thought was going to happen, strategic annexation, saber rattling on newly redefined borders, declaring a victory, and then possibly expanding a little bit further, taking over some city adjacent to it or something like that under peacekeeping auspices. But this, from what you've been looking through, like, this is not the same. Like, the Georgia incursion was not the same as what happened here. This is straight out, you know, Putin's talking about the loss of sovereignty of Ukraine. This is literal capital I invasion.
Yeah. I'm right there with you on wondering if the generals even didn't believe Putin, of like, he always saber rattles, but we'll have the military ready for what we did in Georgia. And what they're doing in Ukraine seems to compare, from what I've read, and I may have been reading too simply, but it seems to compare to what they did in Georgia, which was a little bit of a shambles on the ground, an invasion, but some heavy bombardment got them some cities. And then they achieved their aim of securing South Ossetia and pulled back. The generals maybe caught off the front foot of, like, thought we were just going into the Donbass. You know, I thought maybe the invasion from the north and the south was merely supportive, not let's take Kyiv. So I looked further for, okay, well, what is he up to then? Like, if he doesn't just want to pull the Donbass in, what is he doing? Does he want to conquer Ukraine? Like, well, that seems crazy.
Let's also point out for listeners, when this airs on Wednesday, on Monday, which is when we are recording this, there has been a formal demand, a series of demands from the Russian government that include ceasing of fighting, obviously, of a commitment to not join, from the Ukrainian side, to not join NATO or the EU, and to recognize these newly independent areas that Putin recognized right before the war, the Donbass regions, as independent areas. So that those are the demands right now. Now, the fact that Russia is asking for demands now on day 12 of a military incursion is something that you know might raise some eyebrows. But let's go back into to the context here.
Yeah. So in my poking around, and again, my qualifications here are I wrote a paper on Crimea in 1989 and one on Lithuania in 1989. I dated a Ukrainian girl at college and I do my own poking around here. So apologies to the actual historians if I make a misstep here and there.
We are just people who have made our living researching other things on the internet. We are now applying our research tactics here. That is what we are doing. We are giving you guys a citizens a breakdown of things we found.
So one of the things that I think Jim Briney has been great at highlighting is the sort of tug of war over whether Ukraine would pivot towards Europe or Russia. And she's done a great job of explaining the United States' role in all that. But I dug back a little farther, and because I saw a reference saying there were elements of the Ukrainian constitution that pointed it towards Europe. There were amendments made in 2004. Okay. So way back to the Ukrainian constitution that weakened the powers of the president. They passed with limited debate, and the EU even criticized that limited debate. But basically it said the president can't appoint the prime minister. He can only appoint a couple of cabinet ministers, really shifted it towards a parliamentary system. In 2010, the Constitutional Court was urged under Yanukovych, who was a more sympathetic to Russia president and a Russian-speaking president from the eastern region. The Constitutional Court of Ukraine overturned those 2004 amendments, and Yanukovych then reverted them. So took them out, said those are not applicable anymore, restoring the stronger powers to the president. The European Human Rights Commissioner objected to this because apparently four judges retired from the court in advance of that decision. And the European Human Rights Commissioner claimed that there was political pressure behind that. In other words, they were trying to get the court into shape to do what Yanukovych wanted. Here's the part that got really interesting for me. On February 21st, 2014, so 4 years after those amendments had been reverted, the Ukrainian parliament restored the amendments. This was with a vote. So it wasn't like the first time where they just sort of like sneaked them in. They sent it to Yanukovych. Yanukovych refused to sign those measures. Those amendments did have stronger language on Europe. And when Yanukovych refused to sign them, he was deposed in the Euromaidan. Or the revolution of dignity, the revolution that kicked him out. And they put those amendments back in place, weakening the powers of the president ever since. That was February 21st, 2014, when the parliament restored those amendments. February 22nd, the next day, Russian unrest began in the Donbass.
Gotcha.
August 2014, 6 months later, unmarked tanks rolled into Donetsk, part of the Donbass. And you know, they don't say they're from Russia, but they're Russian tanks without the insignia on them.
Yeah.
And so we get the whole Donbass uprising, the republics that want to separate. Here's where it got even more interesting to me. One of the things I know from studying Russian history in college is that a lot of people don't realize that the Soviet Union was made up of Russia. Tsarist Russia had conquered most all of those lands.
Yeah.
And what Lenin did was he gave some lands independence, quote unquote. You can have your own Soviet Socialist Republic, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova. These were based along ethnic and linguistic lines because Lenin wanted it was the idealistic side, right? It's not the Stalinist Russia. It's the idealistic, the people who are together will work harder together in the worker state. So let's give them control over their regions, even if we have to have some central control from Moscow. And of course, Stalin
centralized this later. Part of when Putin goes into his deep dive history stuff. This is what he was criticizing with Ukraine, that there should have never been the Russian the Russian, Russia as a whole should have stayed what it was. And those cracking off of those little pieces so they could feel better about themselves under the dome of the USSR was a mistake.
Now, the other thing that a lot of people don't realize is even the Russian Soviet Republic, which was part of the USSR, had its own republics within it. There's Tatarstan, there's 20 some republics that are also organized on ethnic lines. And those are a little more autonomous than your oblast or your krai, which are the other subunits. They're more like our states. These are sort of autonomous units that exist within Russia. And so when you go into South Ossetia, probably what I was expecting they wanted in the Donbass was we are going to take those republics, the Republic of South Ossetia, which only Russia recognizes, make it part of Russia as part of the Russian Federation. There is also a union state of Russia and Belarus formed in 1999.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Like on a Venn diagram, there's like a little bit of gray in between them.
Well, so the reason I went into all that Soviet history and the fact that Russia has federated republics is to make sure that we're not talking about that. We are talking about, well, actually, we're not talking about the republics that are autonomous units within Russia. We're talking about something that looks a little more like the USSR, which is in 96, Belarus and Russia declared a commonwealth, where they would have like easier trade and fluid borders. And then in 1999, they made the Union State of Russia and Belarus, which is an EU style organization, or at least it's meant to be. It's kind of moribund. They reinstalled some customs things, but EU also has some custom things going on within its borders. But it is a very nascent attempt by Russia to create an EU around Russia instead of around Europe.
Gotcha.
Or with the rest of Europe. So
So it was just so I could wrap my head around this. So Belarus would have been the first member along with Russia in this union.
Right now it exists. Yeah. There are some free travel. If you're from Belarus, almost Schengen area style travel between Belarus and Russia. They're the only two members. But Abkhazia and South Ossetia, those annexed parts of Georgia, that aren't part of Russia, but have this sort of quasi-republic state, have observer status in that union.
Oh, so they get some kind of benefits.
Yeah.
So Russia sort of trying to offer beyond just saying, okay, well, there's ethnic lines and obviously there's going to be some parts of these countries for which I have more sympathies toward Russia and they got their own beef toward City Hall when it comes to their local government. We also understand that part of the honey that attracts these Soviet republics westward are money and travel and benefits. And what we want to do is create our own little when Walmart first put together their own little version of Amazon Prime, like sure, they don't know exactly how to do it. It's not quite as good as the other one, but it's something.
You got to start somewhere.
EU
thinks it's so hot. Well, yeah. We are going to create a Russian version of that of our own. Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan have both expressed interest in joining, and that Novorossiya project that you've heard so little about is also part of this. Novorossiya is the name of a project that intends to join Donetsk and Luhansk, the two Donbass republics, with southern Ukraine, which it considers to be part of its wider Donbass region, connected to Crimea. Novorossiya would be a federation of the Donbass and Crimea, and Novorossiya would like to also join this union state.
So the two newly recognized independent areas, the connective tissue between those and Crimea, they want to be their own recognized thing, and they would also like to be part of Russia's version of the EU.
Now, all of this has been sort of like, well, that's an interesting fact, but irrelevant in the modern society, right? Because Novorossiya doesn't exist. It didn't have much hope of existing. The union state barely operates. It exists on paper. It has a few benefits, but really has no impact on the world economy. But if you look at the map of where Russian troops are in southern Ukraine, and you look at the map of what Novorossiya would like to be Novorossiya, they are very similar.
You know, and that gets back to part of what was being talked about yesterday in terms of the Russian army, that there were a few experts that I heard and a few things that I read that basically made the point that the reason why things are bad now is almost purely coordination. And without saying it, they were basically saying, like, look, the air power is in one area. The ground power is in another area. The infantry is down south. It feels like everybody's got different aims. And if you were all trying to secure a small piece of land where a bunch of people really kind of wanted you there anyway, then taking the long way round is probably not the worst thing on the planet. When you are trying to subjugate a country of 40 million and you seem to be doing it in from all angles, you need to really concentrate all of your power at the tip of the spear, or else you're going to be in a quagmire because your enemy knows the country better than you do. And they're going to fight harder because it's their land. That is another wrinkle to this, is like, if part of the army's like, hey, look, we were here to help secure this area. We were here to connect these two independent republics to Crimea. And then, you know, we can move on like that. That was what we were planning to do. That's a long weekend job for us, you know, like, and now here we are a fortnight in.
And again, I don't know what I'm talking about when I say this, but
let's underline that again. We are doing our best.
A potential scenario would be to say, we are going to make Novorossiya real. We are going to do that by invading from the east and the south. But in order to ensure the success, we are also going to invade from the north as a feint, put pressure on Kyiv. That way, when we reach a ceasefire, we will more likely be allowed to stay in the south.
Yeah.
And so the column that's broken down, the problems in the north, could be distractions. And that is somewhat the Russian style, to look like you're overreaching in order to be able to retreat to your original goal. I wouldn't be shocked if this ends up with Putin saying, fine, we'll call peace. But we have liberated these Russian speakers in the south, and we'll stick around to ensure their security, but we'll leave the rest of Ukraine. And Ukraine is left with less than it had before, as well as damaged, so that it can't, you know, potentially go and try to take those areas back very easily.
I think if the idea is to cripple Ukraine, we can have a debate on whether or not this is, like, you know, reminder that Russia, I believe, has the fourth largest army in the world. At least that was the stats that I was reading yesterday. You know, this is an embarrassing showing for the fourth largest army in the world. If you are 12 days in and you have been at this level, like, if the real goal here is, no matter what, maybe it is embarrassing, maybe it's not, it doesn't matter, because what you want to do is put tremendous institutional pressure on Ukraine, leave a gigantic problem for the government that's in there, and hopefully let that rot for the next several years. Taking a chunk out of Ukraine would certainly be a part of it. The question is now, you know, is that more or less likely, considering the world has kind of hardened in its opinion against Russia? Like, I feel like in another scenario, where you know, EU allies to Russia, like Germany, you know, have not been pushed as far as they have. You know, you might see some Western pressure to be like, you want to know what? Take the deal, Zelensky. You win. You get to say that you repelled Russia. Give up these two areas. You never have to hear about the Minsk agreement again, and just move on. I don't know if that's the case here, but again, now we're also moving into other areas.
And trust me, I don't either. There's all kinds of holes in the theory, right?
So much has changed, and it continues to change. Like these things that have been recalcitrant of like, oh, Putin, brilliant military mind who always will just take as much as he possibly can because he knows how far he can push the West without them doing something, out the window. Now he's impetuous, possibly dying, sitting at ever longer tables and possibly bad at his job. Who knows? Right. We don't like Germany, the EU, all these things that we're like, well, we know that they're well, no, we don't. I mean, even Switzerland was right? Or, you know, then renouncing neutrality. It's like, what on earth?
I think what I described might have been the plan on paper. Obviously, the one thing that we left out was there will always be a condition that peace requires Ukraine to somehow say they're not going to join NATO. You're not going to get NATO to say someone can't join. That's always been a fool's bargain. No alliance is going to be like, we'll rule out potentials, but you might get Ukraine to say, we will not, you know, some fudgy language of like, we will not pursue membership in the EU or NATO at this time, blah, 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 blah. Putin wants that too. He wants
a constitutional change was his demand. Yeah.
And that is, that goes back to those 2004 amendments and when they were brought back in 2014. Obviously, that pro-Russian unrest in the Donbass began in 2014 when those amendments went in. So maybe you get something changed there. And they're like, well, we're not saying never, but well, I'll take it out of the Constitution. No problem. And then Putin's like, great, I'll just push for a coup later and get my own friendly person in there. No problem. Also, if you think about going into NATO, remember these last 12 days. You know, you don't want to go through that again, do you? It kind of works in his favor. But you're right. That might have been the plan on paper. I mean, I certainly see a world where the oligarchs come in and say, wait, we need peace. And the peace is this plan on paper with Novorossiya separating from Ukraine. But will the rest of the world say like, all right, fine, we'll let you back into SWIFT. We'll turn the gas pipes back on if that's the case. I don't know. They very well may, but I don't know.
I mean, that's the question that I have is, you know, if we see a thawing here from Russia, and it is economically motivated. Number one, this would be probably the most effective use of sanctions I've ever seen in my life because, you know, if there's one thing that I grew up understanding growing up in South Florida, a few miles away from Cuba, is that sanctions can last a very long time. You know, they don't.
There's
not
all kinds of sanctions. Some can be effective. Some are not.
Some are not. Right. And, you know, If that is the case, I mean, I don't want to go relitigate kind of the run up to this, but that's why I also thought that it's like we should have been putting some sanctions on before this happened, when the buildup was happening. If we were uncomfortable with the buildup and stuff like that, you should say, look, we're going to start putting sanctions on because we'll take them off when this troop movement removes.
I mean, I see that both ways because especially looking at this Union State thing, Russia is like, this is no different than, you know, troops in Europe moving around, doing exercises. Yeah. And if you put sanctions on before a country does a thing, well, then you can't put them on as the punishment, right? You don't punish people before they do the thing.
But here's
the thing.
Like,
well, I might as well do the thing because you punished me already.
But we've been moving in levels the entire time. Like that's the only thing is it's like, well, just do the level one and then a level two and then a level three. Before we get out of here, let me talk about something that I know you definitely have a lot of expertise in. And that is how much this affects our supply chain, specifically when you talk about some of the chip shortage, which has been a major issue through the pandemic because of logistical issues getting stuff across the Pacific Ocean, but also for folks, you know, in Russia. Russia, you know, has been criticized by John McCain famously as being a gas station masquerading as a country because they rely so heavily on gas and oil exports. But they also sit on a lot of rare metal mines, and a lot of the stuff is manufactured through Ukraine. So can you give us a sense of from the DTNS perspective?
Yeah.
Whether or not this is going to be a chip shortage issue?
It can be. And there's varying opinions about how much it will be or how long it has to go on before it will be. It's the gases used in chip lithography that seem to be the biggest issue.
Okay.
As part of the steel industry in Russia, there's a lot of gases, particularly krypton and neon gases used in chip making that come in raw form from as a byproduct from Russia. And neon in particular is about 50% of the world's neon gas is refined, because you have to refine it before you use it in lithography, is refined in Odessa. So the chip industry organizations have been saying, you know what, we've got plenty of gas to keep chip lithography going for a while. There are alternative sources that we can encourage. We don't think this will have a material impact this year. If it went on more than a year, you know, check with us then. We might have figured something out. The counter to that is it takes a long time to cultivate those alternate sources because you can't just turn them on. You have to vet them, make sure they're quality. You know the Odessa refinement works. What about these other places if they start doing it? And there's also the toilet paper effect. For lack of a better word, which is, there's plenty of gas for the next year and everybody's worried about running out. So everybody just started buying up more gas and stockpiling it
just in case.
That means now there's a shortage in the gas. There was some talk about, well, if we're not selling chips, Intel and AMD, for instance, aren't selling any of their chips, then not even just the sanctions, but they are not selling even chips that they could sell to Russia under the sanctions. They're not selling. Does that save any for the rest of us? And the fact of the matter is Russia doesn't buy a lot of loose chips. They account for 0.1% roughly of the world's chip consumption. They don't build a lot of things there. The chips going into Russia are usually in products already. So cutting off chip production to Russia doesn't really increase the world supply too much.
Yeah. And so far that is not a big enough industry. Although I guess the gas stuff, I mean, if you had sanctions on gas imports from Russia, then that could affect it, right?
You mean the neon gas?
Krypton
gas? Yeah. I mean, that's already happening. They're already seeing a reduction in that. But again, they think they have enough stockpiles to last through the year if everybody stops stockpiling.
Which, you know, easier said than done.
Yeah.
Well, this is, it's very interesting. I almost really want to do like a very, I'm glad we've stayed away because my natural inclination is to go into like totally hacky, like, you know, so Tom, Putin crazy or not? Is he crazy now? Yes or no?
No, he's not. You have to assume he's not, or he wouldn't have lasted this long. The oligarchs would have taken him out. The question isn't whether he's crazy. The question is, has he lost the confidence of people who support his power? It doesn't appear that he has. Even when the oligarchs are saying it's time for peace, to me, that rings as a part of the plan of like, all right, now you guys go in and start pressing for peace and we'll come to the table and we'll keep knowing, you know, that seems normal. There are way more protests on the street than you might think, given the strict penalties, like 15 years in prison for unlicensed protests on the street. I don't see any indication that they've got to the point where they would topple the government. They seem pretty far from that. So to me, it's not a matter of whether he's crazy. It's a matter of, you know, has he crossed the line where the powers that be in Russia will say, sorry, Vladimir, it was great while it lasted. We need to turn to somebody else. And I don't see any sign of that.
I get. And that's the thing is that I, especially past the run up to this, where a position that I was skeptical of turned out to be 100% right. I want to really interrogate my priors, and my priors here are I would like it if the Russian military all slipped on a banana peel and embarrassed themselves, and Vladimir Putin was just a total, basket case by way of the last few years of COVID, and has like reduced himself to talking to like one butler and a stuffed animal, and everybody else is just kind of pretending that the words that are coming out of his mouth are the same tactician that existed before. That's what I would like in my head. I don't know. I think that you always got to push against that. And I think the reality is probably closer to there was a plan here. And like you pointed out through all of this, it is consistent with this larger plan of destabilizing former Soviet satellite states by way of annexing ethnically Russian areas that already have a beef with their local government, continue to use that as a hedge against NATO and EU adoption. And then maybe this bite of the apple just looked too juicy and he just couldn't help himself and wanted to go further.
Biggest bite of the apple yet, whether he can swallow it or not, the world is waiting to see.
Exactly. And it's like, you know, will he have choked on it? But we will find out. Tom Merritt, host of Daily Tech News Show. Anything else that you want to let the people know about?
If you like hearing what I'm up to, hearing my thoughts, freetomnewsletter.com. Go check it out. Every week I put my thoughts in there, what I've been up to, links to all my shows, freetomnewsletter.com.
There you go. Thanks a lot, buddy.
Thanks, man.
Politics, Politics, Politics is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. If you would like to thank Tom for that conversation, you can go ahead on over to px3guest.com. You can always email the program, theyoungamerican@gmail.com. Hit us up on Twitter, px3 tweets. Our Twitch is px3 live. We've been missing an action there. For a couple, probably a week and a half by the time that we get back to it. But we're back next week. Our podcast can be shared at px3podcast.com and get all your merch at Politics Merch. Hey, one more thanks to Alan Y for being just what an amazing stud, donating financially to the show. Thank you for your generosity, sir. If you would like to be like him and send me some Venmo money, some online funds, you can do so. The Venmo is Justin-Young-20. Our PayPal is paypal.me/payjury. Our Cash App is PX3Cash. And you can always send a physical check, P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas 78715. Just go ahead and make it out to Justin. Of course, the only way to get our bonus content is go to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week covering all the news that we miss on our free podcast schedule. And the $10 tier gets you all that and your name read like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. Unsafe DB level. Idris Arslandian, DJ Katie Mack, Niemeister, Dr. G, Admiral Flapjack, Utah Jimmy Montana, Edmund Pluribus Unum, Pete Spicery, 70s TV salesman, or spy, D Really, and vote Gloria Young for King of the New World Order. Zombie Doc, Edison, no mention on the podcast, please. .com Junkie, DB4 Bongo, Jewish Lives Matter, 100 Mile Runner, Staff Sergeant Poopers, Berkeley Steven, Diana Silent Slumbers, Katie Stitch, Adam L., Double K Ranch, EO Pinball Shop, John, The Opposable Thumbs for Dogs Foundation, Super Zoomy, Neil, Charles, Darren, Olin and Angela, DL, Steven, Chad, Matt, Miranda, Janelle, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, Paul, Dustin, Richard, D Laser, Just Another Pilot, Middle Age, Mike, The Gen, J Pink, and Andrew. If you would like your name read right there, then head on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Doing a feed drop on Friday. We will be back with you. I'll be fully recovered on Monday. Till next time, this is your old pal, Justin Robert Young, saying, Some shows talk about politics. Others talk about politics and still more discuss politics. But this is the only show that dares discuss
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.